Tehran reacts to the EU's new sanctions on a number of Iranian officials and entities, saying that it will soon release a list of reciprocal bans. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas slams the U.S. Security Council for a watered-down statement that replaced the resolution condemning Israel's settlement plans. And China pledges to promote dialogue to resolve the Ukraine conflict, urging certain countries to stop adding fuel to the fire there. Thanks for joining us. Iran has vowed to impose retaliatory sanctions against the EU after the bloc slapped fresh bans on Tehran over the recent riots in the country. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said the countermeasures will be announced soon. The EU imposed asset freezes and visa bans on 32 individuals and two entities, including Iran's education and culture ministers. The UK has also blacklisted eight individuals. Most of those targeted are lawmakers, judiciary officials, and prison authorities. Western powers have imposed several rounds of such sanctions on Iran in recent months, accusing the country of cracking down on protesters. Tehran has repeatedly dismissed the accusations, saying that it has been lawfully dealing with rioters disrupting public security. Iran says the West is using human rights as a tool in its pressure campaign against the country. Journalist and political analyst Mohammad Ali Araki tells us why the West has been imposing sanctions on Iran.
Since it started from the 1979 until now, the U.S. has tried to bring the Islamic Republic of Iran under its paws to try and get the fist of the Islamic Republic. And technically, we know that the Islamic Republic of Iran has always refused to bow down to the United States of America and its allies in the region. They have literally run out of sanctions. The United States of America have run out of sanctions. The fact that they've entered education, this shows the absolute desperation of Washington, D.C., the people in the White House or the Congress. It completely shows that. The fact that they've targeted culture. Now, we know the main war that the United States of America has with the Islamic Republic of Iran and their framework, their ideas, it's an ideological war. It's an ideological war because the United States of America has a problem with the ideology that the Islamic Republic has. And therefore, the ideology that Iran has, that is the biggest harm, the biggest threat to America and their friends. The ideology, the culture that the Islamic Republic of Iran implements, you can see this everywhere in the region. The cultural work that the Islamic Republic of Iran does, this makes the building, the structure of the United States of America wobble.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has denounced the U.N. Security Council for taking an understated stance on Israel's plan to expand settlements in the occupied territories. Hamas' condemnation comes after the UNSC fell short of passing a resolution which would have demanded the regime put an end to its settlement activities. Hamas says issuing a statement instead of passing a resolution shows the world body has evaded its responsibilities to ensure that international regulations and conventions are not violated. On Monday, the 15-member body issued a statement expressing deep concern and dismay over Israel's announcement of settlement expansion. It said the regime scheme would jeopardize the viability of a so-called two-state solution. The statement, however, does not have the binding force of a resolution draft submitted earlier to the UNSC. Israel has recently authorized 9 settlement outposts in the occupied West Bank. Israel is pressing ahead with its arbitrary detention of Palestinians in the occupied territories. Regime forces have arrested nearly 24 people in the fresh raids across the West Bank. 15 Palestinians were detained after the regime's troops raided a refugee camp south of the city of Hebron. Others were taken into custody after the military made incursions into other areas in the West Bank. Israel's deadly crackdown against Palestinians and their unjustified detention continue unabated. Hundreds of Palestinians have been languishing in Israeli jails for years without charge or trial. In protest at the regime's illegal detention and inhumane treatment, Palestinian inmates have been staging a hunger strike for the eighth day in a row. The removal of an Israeli diplomat from a summit of the African Union has triggered controversy. The union says it suspended Israel's observer status at the bloc last year, so no Israeli should have attended in the first place.
We have not invited any Israeli to this assembly. We have noted that somebody entered the hall with a badge. We asked the individual to quickly leave the hall. This is a person who does not reside in Ethiopia, and we are conducting investigations to know how the individual got accredited. Therefore, ladies and gentlemen of the press, we have not invited any Israeli authorities. We are going to push this investigation to the fullest to know where the error was coming from.
Video circulating on social media shows security personnel confronting the Israeli diplomat. That's during the opening ceremony of the summit before the diplomat leaves the auditorium. Israel has claimed its envoy was an accredited observer and has slammed South Africa and Algeria for the expulsion of the envoy. The regime attained observer status at the bloc in 2021. South Africa and Algeria protested the decision at the time. They said that it runs counter to the bloc's statements in support of Palestinians. Earlier, political analyst Zafar Bangash told us about Israeli efforts to, quote, penetrate Africa.
Well, you know, we need to keep in mind that Israel is a pariah state, and it needs to be, recognized. It wants recognition, so it has been blackmailing and bribing some of the African rulers, and I'm sure that there is something untoward and illegal going on between the chairman of the African Union and Israel, because he took that decision unilaterally. But for Israel, of course, you know, it wants to penetrate Africa. It wants to claim that it is being recognized by the rest of the world. And I'm glad that South Africa and Algeria took this principled stand and they pushed for Israel's expulsion. And I also like to pay tribute to the efforts of civil society groups in South Africa, in particular Africa for Palestine and the Media Review Network, that had carried a vigorous campaign through the South African government to throw Israel out of that union and not grant them observer status.
Moroccans have held demonstrations against rising costs of food and fuel, despite a government ban on protests.
Our lives are becoming more expensive. Almost never we have experienced that before. All food prices have gone up enormously. Fuel prices have gone up, and when you know that the head of the government is the one who has the largest company in the oil sector, then you can see how interested this government is in social justice.
Protesters, mostly members of the Democratic Labor Confederation, gathered in front of Parliament in Rabat as well as in other cities. They chanted slogans against their deteriorating purchasing power. The government had placed a ban on marches after declaring a state of health emergency during the COVID-19 pandemic, but the measure still remains in force. Morocco has seen months of rising prices and growing calls for caps on energy firms' profits, but Rabat blames recent price hikes on speculation about basic goods. According to the World Bank, the country's inflation peaked at 8.3% at the end of 2022. Prime Minister Aziz Ahanouch has, however, promised to strengthen market control and lower prices in the coming days. China vehemently denies U.S. accusations that it is planning to send military aid to Russia for the war in Ukraine. China's foreign ministry spokesman countered that it is the Americans who are endlessly shipping weapons to the battlefield. Wang Wenbin also reiterated a call to support a Chinese proposal to find a political solution to the Ukraine crisis. Beijing says it will publish the proposal this week. The U.S. has warned that any move by Beijing to provide Moscow with lethal support would seriously damage bilateral relations. The EU has issued a similar warning. Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen says the island is expanding its military cooperation with the U.S. as she takes a swipe at what she calls China's expansionism.
Taiwan and the United States continue to bolster military exchanges. And going forward, Taiwan will cooperate even more actively with the U.S. and other democratic partners to confront global challenges such as authoritarian expansionism and climate change.
President Tsai made the comment during a meeting with a visiting delegation of U.S. lawmakers. The head of the delegation said that the trip is aimed at bolstering security and economic ties with Taiwan. This comes a week after the senior U.S. State Department official traveled to the island. The visit by U.S. officials to Taipei has increased over the past months, despite repeated warnings from China against growing diplomatic and military nexus between the U.S. and Taiwan. China considers the island as part of its territory and believes the U.S. support emboldens pro-independence forces in Taiwan. The Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has met with the Omani Sultan Haytham bin Darik al-Said during his one-day visit to Muscat. Assad and the Omani Sultan discussed regional issues and the expansion of bilateral ties. Sultan Haytham also extended his condolences to the Syrian president and the victims of the recent devastating earthquakes. Bashar al-Assad, for his part, thanked the Omani nation and government for their solidarity with the Syrian people in the aftermath of the quakes. Assad's trip comes amid moves by a number of Arab countries to mend fences with Damascus after cutting off ties following foreign-backed militancy in the country in 2011. Countries including Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates have already restored ties with Syria since Syrian armed forces effectively defeated foreign-backed militancy. We've asked journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier about the significance of Assad's visit to Oman.
It is indeed significant because it's an ouverture of President Assad visiting more than one Arab and Middle Eastern country, and also receiving, as you rightly said, the visit of the Jordanian foreign minister for the first time since years. So what we understand is that the earthquake is pushing all the Arab countries to have another look through a humanitarian window rather than the political aspect when dealing with the Syrian president, the Syrian government, and the Syrian population. Not only, we've seen also European countries like Italy, Greece, Cyprus, and Austria calling their European state members to accept the status quo and to acknowledge the presence of an elected president in Syria, and that whatever has been done in the past, we need to go over it. And they're calling to stop the boycott, to start the reconstruction, to all the sanctions, and to look toward the future, to build the future relationship with Syria rather than staying on the side. However, the war in Ukraine is keeping everybody busy. This is why the earthquake has attracted some attention, but it is not clear for how long this attention will be.
The 38th Fajr International Music Festival is underway in Tehran, while the capital is hosting over 2,000 musicians from across the country. Foreign music bands have also found the opportunity to go on stage. Gisu Mishahmadi reports.
Bringing charm to the Iranian capital with some of the most beautiful Persian orchestra pieces and musical performances to jam-packed concert halls in Tehran, the most prestigious musical event in Iran is underway. The 38th Fajr International Music Festival opened in Tehran on February the 17th. While the capital is hosting over 30 music bands from across the country, foreign musicians have also found the opportunity to go on stage, including Hungarian musicians. Seven concert halls in Tehran, as well as over 30 other arenas in 14 provinces, are hosting this year's event.
I am grateful to the musicians that took part in the festival this year. I would also like to take the opportunity to tell you that we have added some awards to our list, and other than the Barbat Prize for the Best Music Album, as of this year, we will also have the Best Song, Lyrics, and Media Awards.
Over 2,000 musicians are taking part, either in the competitive Borbat Prize section or the non-competitive pop, traditional, and orchestral music sections. What was made this year's event even more special is the performance of the Iranian Police Force Music Band.
It was an honor to perform in the Fajr Music Festival, and I'm glad that military bands now also have a place in this prestigious event. I hope that more bands take part in the future.
But still, as always, the traditional and folk music sections are under the spotlight, adding glitz and glamour to the name Fajr, which means dawn in Farsi and refers to a 10-day period that led to the victory of the Islamic Revolution. This has been the reason to hold cultural events, including a theater, a film, and a music festival, going by the same name every year. The final part of a trio of cultural events to honor the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, the 38th Fajr International Music Festival, is currently underway. The festival will end on February the 22nd. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
And that is for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember, in the previous episode, we discussed the events before the passing away of Imam Khomeini. You heard that the Imam suffered from heart problem, although he was trying not to worry his family, especially his wife. However, Ms. Khadija Saghafi had somehow realized that Imam Khomeini's health was deteriorating, and he had to rest more, and he checked up from time to time. Today, we are going to dwell upon the sad event of Imam Khomeini's passing away. Stay tuned, please. Before Imam Khomeini's hospitalization, his wife was suffering from a painful backache, and physicians had prescribed 3 weeks of full rest for her. But the Imam was hospitalized just after 1 week. So Ms. Saghafi had to wake up early every morning to visit the Imam. She relates the story. To avoid disturbance for others, especially the medical team, Hajj Isa from among the Imam's servants was assigned to coordinate with the head of the team, Dr. Arefi, to determine a time for visit so that nobody was in the room. Thus, I would go to the hospital in the morning to ask about the Imam's health. He would also ask about my health and my backache and tell me not to walk much, not to go up and down the stairs, rest more and take care of my health. He was always worried about my health. In those days, he used to tell me, "I'm departing. Pray for my departure." When I asked him which part of his body hurt, he would say, "My whole body hurts." That would impress me very much and made me cry. But I would avoid crying and would tell him, "Inshallah, you will be fine and leave the hospital soon." Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, would never neglect his daily worship, even though he was suffering from numerous pains at hospital. Everyone who had visited him in the last days of his life says that he kept praying in those critical moments. The Imam was very much concerned about the exact time of daily ritual prayer. So, whenever he opened his eyes, he would ask it. His elder daughter, Ms. Sedire Mustafavi, says, "My father, like before, wouldn't spare us ethical advice during the last days of his life. When we went to him for having food, he told me and my sisters several times, 'The way of the hereafter is hard. Do not commit a sin. Refraining from sin is easier than God's punishment. Perform the ritual obligatory prayer in time, even if you are on the sidewalk.'" Dear listeners, Farideh Mustafavi, another daughter of Imam Khomeini, also relates, "The Imam's health had seriously deteriorated on the last day of his life, but he performed the midday and afternoon prayers. He had fainted and was in coma at the time of the dusk and night prayer, but the physicians announced the time of prayer to inform him. I saw myself that the Imam performed prayer in death agony with his fingertips and the movement of his eyelids. The last day of his life, the Imam's health further deteriorated, and he asked all his family members gather around him." His daughter continues, "The Imam said the family to hurry up. I called my sisters and the girls. Everybody gathered around his bed. After a few minutes, he turned to me and said, 'Anyone who wants to stay here, let them stay. And anyone who wants to leave, let them go. Please turn off the light. I want to sleep.'" Imam Khomeini's family members were highly concerned and went to the hospital repeatedly. It was heard that the Imam would be operated again. His wife was aware of the Imam's severe weakness and she was very upset at the decision. So she protested the head of the medical team. Dr. Arefi calmed Imam Khomeini's wife and assured her that there was no need to operate him. Ms. Mostafavi says, Dr. Arefi told the mother not to be worried as the Imam was fine. Then he showed the mother the way to his room. Then he told me, as the lady is informed of the Imam's condition and thinks that we want to operate him again, that's why she is a bit upset. If you like, I will speak to the lady on the issue. I said, there is no choice because the lady should know everything and we should have informed her earlier. When the lady came out the Imam's room, Dr. Arefi seated her on a corner and explained to her the Imam's latest condition. Upon hearing this, the lady looked to submit and consider everything finished. So she didn't say anything and stood up calmly and left the hospital. The last day of Imam Khomeini's life was very hard for his wife. She took some pills and fell asleep. But when she woke up, the Imam had passed away. He departed the mortal world on June 3, 1989. When asked about that day, she said, it was very hard. I didn't know how much pain the Imam was suffering from. Little by little, I realized that he was departing. I was sick myself, and I couldn't tolerate this disaster. Although I was strong and patient in my life, and I have passed through calamities, now I am weak and old, and the pressure of this disaster is too great for me. Miss Sagafi was so sick that she couldn't even accompany the Imam's sacred body to Beheshte Zahra Cemetery. Later on, she related on the issue. 13 days of the Imam's hospitalization was like 13 centuries for me. When I was sitting at his bed, my mind would travel to some of the dimensions of his character through history. When I went to bed at night, hundreds of issues would flash through my mind. Sometimes I would be plunged in his mystic perceptions that had been uttered or penned down by him. Dear listeners, Imam Khomeini passed away at 22:23 on June 3, 1989, and plunged into grief not only Iran, but also Muslims and the oppressed in the world.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, in a classic case of do what I say, not what I do, the U.S. Secretary of State has warned China not to arm Russia in its battle against Ukraine, while the United States has armed and funded Ukraine to the tune of at least $50 billion since the war started. Now, this as there is growing discontent amongst the American public regarding the U.S.'s support for Ukraine. There was a large demonstration in Washington, D.C. on Sunday protesting against the American war machine and its support for Kiev. But who's listening? Certainly not the U.S. president, who landed in Kiev on Monday and promised $500 million more in military aid and equipment to Ukraine. Well, I'd like to welcome my guests. They're going to help me to look at this overall situation, what's going on to the program. Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst out of Brussels. And Andriy Dobryansky, chairman of UN Affairs Ukrainian World Congress out of New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with me. Let me start this off with Gilbert. What do you make of the U.S.'s continued support of Ukraine when there's growing discontent even inside of the United States for that support?
Well, this has become an existential challenge for the United States. It started out as an optional participation, a proxy war, but de facto it has become an existential war for the United States because its leadership in the world, its hegemony has been put in question by the course of the economic war against Russia, which has turned adversely to the United States, by the de-dollarization that we see that has accompanied the support of a number of countries in the Middle East and China for Russia. And so the United States is compelled to continue support in what few people at the top understand is a losing proposition.
Okay, Andriy, your take on this, because it does seem that there is less and less enthusiasm from the American public of giving these billions to Ukraine, but we actually see Washington enhancing its support. Your overall take?
If it was truly the case, then this week, when you're going to see proclamations from mayors, governors, and the United States honoring the sacrifices of the Ukrainian people during this year, then something's at odds there. Yes, you alluded to a couple of hundred people that flew the flag of the occupier of Ukraine in Washington, D.C. Certainly does not represent the bulk of Ukrainian of the American people. And you will see that this week, not only with these resolutions, as I mentioned, proclamations, these elected officials on all scopes of government here in the United States, even lighting up our buildings with the colors of Ukraine. You're going to see a demonstration more so than just President Biden.
Okay. Gilbert, your take, because we are hearing more and more and seeing, because Americans are actually suffering themselves right now with the deteriorating infrastructure, and we know that they're seeing a lot of problems right now, whether we're talking about derailing trains or lack of clean water to drink, that Americans are saying, well, concentrate on us, American government. Let us concentrate on us and not send so many billions outside of the country. Do you think that that is going to make a difference, that they will be able to pressure Washington or not?
Well, I agree with my fellow panelist, which will surprise him, that the demonstrations that we have seen or the unhappiness with the economic difficulties in the United States that are resulting from the blowback of the sanctions imposed on Russia, this is having little to no effect on the conduct of the war and American official support for Ukraine. The situation will be resolved on the ground. This is something that all sides have said going back months was the outcome that they want to see, and they will see it. But regrettably for my fellow panelists, it will not be in Ukraine's favor. The latest developments, which are vigorously denied in Munich, where they spoke about the war situation as if Ukraine had already won, the situation on the ground in Bakhmut today is dire for the Ukrainian forces. And this is not an insignificant post. It was made into a real battering ram, a defense of Ukraine by Mr. Zelensky. And he has sacrificed maybe 20,000 Ukrainian troops to hold it, and it's about to be lost. It is virtually encircled at present, and the military equipment and ammunition that has been supplied to those defenders of Bakhmut is about to be cut off. We will see an end there, very similar to what happened in Mariupol. That is not a good sign for Ukraine because it opens the road for the conquest of the remainder of the Donbas and Lugansk oblasts, just to the west of this important Bakhmut nexus is Kramatorsk, and beyond that, Slavyansk. Slavyansk was the first calling cry, a rallying cry of the Russian spring of 2014, when it held out for 85 days against a vastly superior Ukrainian military force. It will be retaken, and with that, the whole Donbas will be in Russian hands in a matter of weeks.
Andrzej, your take on this, because on the one hand, we heard that actually Russia is saying, or had been saying, to the West not to increase the amount of money or supplies or equipment that they give Ukraine because it will cause more suffering for the Ukrainians and it will extend the war. You heard our guests in Brussels basically saying that Russia is on the move right now. Your overall perspective, would it not be better to sit down and have talks, these two sides, or do you think that this war just should continue in the way it is with so many people dying, especially Ukrainians?
Anybody can do a search online to hear people prognosticating about the fall of Bakhmut for the last 6 months, since the summer at least. Russia is imminently taking over that area. As with any declarations by Russia, we have to take it as a grain of salt. Yesterday was the one-year anniversary of the Russian ambassador to the United States declaring assertively on American national television that Russia will not be increasing its invasion of Ukraine, which it 3 days later. So let's just take that with a grain of salt. But it's great to bring up Mariupol because I will be at the United Nations this week, as will many foreign ministers from across the world. And there is a plan that has been put out by President Zelensky, and that is something that the General Assembly and everybody will start talking about. We need to start talking about the 10-point plan, which begins by demilitarizing nuclear plants. We cannot have the situation as recently as this weekend of Russia increasing the military fortifications around the largest nuclear power plant in Europe, and so on and so forth, including the situation in Mariupol, which I will be talking about, given the fact that the numerous war crimes, which thankfully the United States has recognized, and numerous more countries will come in terms of full-fledged recognition of the war crimes by the Russian state against the Ukrainian people. This is the eventuality of Russia, which is doing all these war crimes up until the point that they are not only stopped, but they are tried publicly.
So you're saying, Andrzej, you're saying that actually the Russians do not have the upper hand. Is that what you're saying?
The Russians have been claiming an upper hand for...
No, I want to know what you're saying. Are you saying that they do not?
I am saying that they do not because
okay.
I've never seen them demonstrate an upper hand.
Okay. Gilbert, your take on this, there seems to be... it's an amazing schism that has taken place. And it goes back, I mean, what Angela Merkel said about the Minsk agreement and sitting down and talking and trying to work this out. But, of course, unfortunately, that did not happen. And still to date, there seems to be a lot of denial on, unfortunately, the prospects of more death and dying and destruction. Your take on this, why do we see, on one hand, what's happening at the war front. On the other hand, we look at especially mass media and the way this is being projected.
Well, mass media globally are predominantly owned and directed by the United States. There's no question but that Ukraine and the United States have won the information war. They have excluded Russian news sources. They have issued a blackout on Russian reports. Even, and this is very interesting, it's not just the general public that is left in the dark. It is the very experts within the Pentagon and their advisors who are also in the dark.
What does that mean? How is that possible that the Pentagon officials can be left in the dark? Expand on that for me.
Well, I've been in correspondence with a retired lieutenant colonel from the United States who is on an active participant in a think tank and advising to the Pentagon. And it has become clear in our correspondence that this man hasn't a clue as to the overall picture of the war. He was ignorant about its basic nature as a civil war within Ukraine. The United States Pentagon is talking about the wonderful morale of the Ukrainian forces because they're fighting for their own land, and the lack of morale or declining morale on the Russian side, which would have terrible consequences for the outcome of the war because they're not fighting for their own land. But this is rubbish. About a third of all forces on the Russian side are the militias of the Donetsk and Luhansk oblasts, now republics and now parts of the Russian Federation. They are fighting for their own land in the same way that the people from Kiev think they're fighting for their own land. It is a civil war that has been aggravated by the interventions from outside, very much like the Spanish Civil War. Regrettably, the Spanish Civil War was the antechamber to World War II. I'm very hopeful that this will not be the antechamber to World War III, though it has such a possibility. The history is written by the victors. So the current hands-down victory in the information war by the United States is a mirage. The Ukrainian side will lose, and the Russian side will win, and they will write the history.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
About that, Andre. I mean, we look at from 2014 and what has been happening in the Eastern Province and Donbas, and one would definitely say that it's more likely it would start off as a civil war, as Ukrainian forces were actually attacking those areas. Your take on all of this and how it's going down. The beginning, if we look at the very beginning and what happened, do you agree or disagree with that account that actually Ukrainian forces were attacking their own people in those regions from 2014 after the Maidan?
This Sunday, the 26th, in the early pre-dawn hours of 2014, Russian forces crossed over into Ukraine. It'll be 9 years of Russian forces advancing onto Ukraine. There is no civil war where Caspian Sea launches ballistic missiles towards Ukrainian territory. There is no civil war wherein that's a part of it. Obviously, the international community rejects these kind of fanciful projections. And it is true that the history does belong to the victor. And we see that the entire international community, over 100 nations at the United Nations, are committed to this, including actions of the, sorry, the statements of the three African countries on the Security Council forcefully condemning this neocolonialism. This is something that has to stop, and we hope that it will be stopped in the near future.
Okay. Well, Gilbert, this situation, because, of course, Press TV, actually, we have a correspondent on the ground there in Donetsk, and the picture that he's painting right now is one, first of all, very grave, very serious, but also with the people being very happy that the Russian forces are there. And he has shown time and time again Ukrainian forces attacking or launching missiles or bombing those same areas. So, again, when we have this corporate media picture of what is happening and the majority of people seeing it that way, I mean, what will it take? Is it only just a continuation of this war that can show the reality on the ground? Do you think that there is any possibility of talks being able to end this conflict?
Well, as the Russians pursue their offensive, which will not be shock and awe, but will be across large stretches of the front lines in the coming weeks, I think that it will be clear, even to the thick skulls in Washington, in the Pentagon, that their side is losing badly. And at that time, I think there will be tom-toms or the drums calling for peace. So I don't look at for anti-war movement. It is insignificant to non-existent. But I do look for some attempt by people at the top in Washington to save a little bit, scrap of Ukraine, which they can claim as a victory and as a sovereign state in the future, even if it is a rump state without large parts of its territory.
Andrei, do you feel at all that the United States and NATO have been using your people and your country to actually initiate this conflict to begin with? Because if we see the expansion of NATO and that it came up on the borders of Russia, and that Russia over the years kept saying, do not expand, do not come closer. And we know that the United States, for example, if there was a hostile country, if you want to call it, let's say Mexico, that that definitely would not allow that to happen, that it would fall in another, like in the enemy, if you want to say, front. So with that being said, do you think at all that the Ukrainians have been used in this game, in the hegemonic game that NATO and the United States are in participating in?
We have numerous international treaties and obligations of which Russia has broken almost every single one. Where Ukraine was deceived was the fact that it gave up the third largest nuclear arsenal in history. It was deceived in signing numerous bilateral agreements with the Russian Federation, only to have every single one of them ripped up by rocket attacks on its territory, by tanks crossing over onto Ukrainian territory. There was never an attack on Russia. It has been only an attack on its former colonies. I think the people of the world have spoken almost consistently throughout this entire conflict, condemning what Russia has done in Ukraine, condemning the newly discovered evidence about MH17 and the fact that Russia shot down those 298 innocent civilians, condemning all the numerous breaches of international law that Russia has committed since Putin took power, not just against the Ukrainian people, against the Georgian people, against his own people. It is only a matter of time, in my estimation, to see how long this so-called federation lasts north of Ukraine. It is surely in its last days. It doesn't have an economy to speak of. We will see where it goes in the future.
Okay. Well, my guest in Brussels, you're laughing. Any comments there, Gilbert?
Well, I commend my fellow panelist on a very effective and well-thought-through propaganda speech. But he said he will be appearing in various forums in the coming weeks, and this is obviously what he was going to say there. I will not try to go head-to-head with him on each point. When he speaks about the world condemning, he's talking about 40% of the world, where 60% of the world by population has stood back and disagreed with the United States over who is to blame, or if anyone is to blame, for the current confrontation. The situation is complex. my friend has made it very simplified for himself. But I think regrettably, it comes to the situation on the ground in the war to resolve it for all of us, including for my fellow panelists.
Well, Gilbert, would you say that the main reason for this persistent support of Ukraine by the U.S. and its European allies is the transition, actually, of economic power from the West to the East, and in many ways that they believe that they have no other choice but war, because what we're witnessing is the crumbling of the old liberal world order and the de-dollarization process. Your take on that, Gilbert?
The world has imposed, the United States has imposed, together with the EU, the most severe sanctions of all time in history. The United States started this with the confiscation of $350 billion in reserves that Russia had when it trusted the global economic system to function in an open and fair way. It didn't. The United States abused its position of dominance to punish Russia in a way that had never occurred before. And yet, despite all the sanctions, I would just like to bring up one fact. The Rosstat, the Russian agency which issues the economic news, the financial news about Russia, has just concluded and published the fact that in 2022, the Russian economy contracted by 2.1%. Just remember that at the outset of the war, projections were made in the West that Russia would have a 20% collapse, that Russia would be on its knees. Nothing of the sort happened. And that is not only because of the internal strength of the Russian economy, it's because of the support it has received from most of the world. China, India. India has increased its import from Russia by 10 or more times. The world at large has supported Russia. And my fellow panelists' notion of voting in the UN General Assembly misjudges what the weight in favor of Russia is in the world.
Okay, I'm just about out of time. Andre, 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Well, there's plenty to say, not least of which is that Russia had probably the worst economy in January 2023 since it had since the late 90s. So clearly the actions put on by the rest of the world in concert against the Russian Federation, not out of a whim, not out of aggression, but in response to their actions killing people, have clearly made an effect, and that will lead to their downfall.
Okay, and unfortunately, I'm out of time. I appreciate both of you being with me here on this spotlight. Gilbert Doctorow out of Brussels and Andre Dobrensky out of New York. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa by a shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, where welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Shaykh Karimi is the guest speaker for today's discussion. Assalamu alaikum, Shaykh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
So again, the important topic of the spread of Islam from the early times of Islam, the advent of Islam up until now, was it through victory or colonization, or is better to say the power of the sword? What does historical facts tell us?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. There is a kind of stereotype, widespread among some of the people who, non-Muslims who have studied about Islam, and that is the claim that Islam, Islam is the religion of sword, meaning that the religion which was spread in different countries through power, through force. And on the other hand, the same people who are mainly Christians, they claim that Christianity is the religion of mercy and compassion and so on and so forth. So first of all, I would like to mention that, if they claim that we have kind of an Islamic emperor in the history of mankind, so the same is true about Christianity. In some periods, in some times and era, in different places, we have some government in the name of Christianity.
Yes.
And then they killed a lot of innocent people, especially the Muslims when it comes to crusades. We know that, thousands of Muslims were innocently killed by the crusaders. But the point is that as Muslims, we do not attribute this to Christianity.
Yes.
So we need to distinguish between the acts done by the followers of the religion, any religion, and the true doctrines of that religion.
For example, Greek Empire or Roman Empire.
Exactly.
Or something, or Latin Empire or something
so
like that.
So my first point is that given that Islam was spread through force, if we suppose that, of course, we do not agree with that.
Okay.
But now the question is that, what was done, was it in accordance with the teachings of Islam or
yes.
No, it was the actions of some ignorant Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
These are two different scenarios here, so
yes.
we need to distinguish and we do the same regarding Christians. In many cases, what is done by Christian people are according to us as Muslims against the teachings of Jesus. So we shouldn't claim that this is Christianity. No, Christianity
yes.
is a divine religion.
And we know that at the very beginning of the religion of Islam, when it was established in Medina, Mecca, Prophet Muhammad, through the language of peace, you know, peace talks, peaceful coexistence, you know, spread Islam, even in his war with the unbelievers and the polytheists of the Mecca, there was no bloodshed. Opportunity was given even to the children, to the women, old men and women to leave the city. And then, you know, through peace and peace talks, everything was spread over there. But unfortunately, after the